Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll hear from Rosemary Gladstar about her book, Medicinal Herbs, A Beginner's Guide. We'll also hear tonight from Maddie Scully, chair of the Performing Arts Department at San Bernardino Valley College, with Don Giovanni and more in the near future. We're going to start in conversation with Dane Hucklebridge. His recent book is No Beast So Fierce, the terrifying true story of the Chippewa tiger, the deadliest animal in history, actually in the Guinness Book of World Records as far as the highest number of fatalities from a single tiger. So first, talking about the Chippewa tiger, if you could go into it, what it was and when it was, and we even have to tackle pretty much where it was. Not everybody just knows Chippewa or Uttarakhand off the top of their head. Even if we say Nepal, it wouldn't mean much.
Well, it started in around the year 1900. It's hard to say exactly when. And it continued, though, right up to 1907. So at least, I would say, 7, 8, possibly even 9 years, something in that span. And well, it began in Nepal, in western Nepal, and then eventually the tiger was chased out of Nepal and crossed over to India, where the killing continued, to a region known as Kumaon.
I can just picture some folks hearing about, oh, we're talking about this great hunter, so let's dismiss this right away. One, I think he was relatively unknown at the time of the hunting, but he also became a champion for tigers later on. But first of all, this tiger, this is actually a record breaker, if you will. It's a horrible way to put this, as far as the biggest rampage or something to that effect in the Guinness Book. Let's talk about why this tigress actually started changing her habits and taking down so many humans.
Sure. I mean, tigers, a natural, normal, healthy tiger in a normal, healthy environment is an extremely elusive, extremely shy animal. I mean, you can live, you know, in tiger country without ever seeing a tiger for a whole lifetime. And something happened essentially that was so drastic as to totally transform this tiger so it wasn't acting like a tiger at all. And what became clear doing research for this is that this supposed freak of nature was actually a man-made disaster, both in the direct sense that at a young age it had been injured by a poacher's bullet, it had had two of its teeth knocked out essentially by a misaimed shot. And during that time, it had been unable to hunt its normal prey, you know, the sort of stags and wild boar, things like that, a healthy tiger would be able to take down. And just to keep from starving to death, it had started hunting the only animals it could actually catch, which were human beings. And so that's the very direct way that it was a man-made disaster. But I think the more indirect way was just sort of what was happening with colonial policies at the time and the way the environment was being treated. You see the British colonial government, you know, massive deforestation to get timber for railroads. You see agricultural expansion to try to increase grain revenues where jungles and wetlands were being cleared and turned into farmland. And you see things like livestock diseases be from like big cattle stations that were being opened, you know, just decimating whole populations of deer, sort of prey that tigers normally feast on. And yeah, it just created this perfect storm where this tiger started eating people and didn't have as much habitat and didn't have as much prey as previously. And just this rampage continued and it ate people instead for a very long length of time.
It was, 430-something people?
The reported number is 436. And again, it's hard to confirm it with any sort of precision just because you're talking about over a century ago in a very kind of rugged, remote frontier region that was pretty far from any major cities or anything like that. So it's hard to document every kill or anything like that. But the reported tally is 436. And I did find quite a few like newspaper articles and colonial records that didn't confirm that number exactly, but at least confirmed that a very large number of people were being eaten by this tiger.
Right. Now, I'm glad you mentioned colonization a couple of times now. It really struck me as to when they may have decided to hunt this tigress, and not to appear too cold, but I wonder how many villagers were taken down before the tigress actually killed somebody, say, more directly related to the company, the East India Company, and therefore getting the British involved and getting this Irishman to go on the hunt.
Sure. I would say probably the vast majority of its victims would have been, you know, from the rural population in western Nepal and Kumaon. Mm. I'm not aware of it. It almost killed Jim Corbett, who was the hunter, eventually went after it.
Yeah.
I'm not personally aware of it having amongst the victim tally any members of the British government or things like that. It's possible. I'm not sure. But that's sort of the sad part of the story, is that, you know, a lot of the sort of the decimation of the landscape of the environment, environmental destruction, was enacted by the British government, by the colonial elite. But the vast majority of its victims would have been the local rural population.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. We will get to Corbett the conservationist in just a moment, because this is a great, great part of him, saving animals. He's credited with killing the tigress, and I suppose I initially pictured him, you know, tracking the tiger and learning her tendencies and, you know, let's just say hunting. But I understand that the killing of this particular tigress came from using a bunch of villagers to doing a beatdown of a field, that is, these people wandering through a field and just chasing her out of where she was hiding. Kind of akin to setting a forest on fire and shooting the deer as they emerge?
Yeah, that's a very good comparison, because, I mean, one thing, Jim Corbett, you know, this was a different type of hunting, one that he was not accustomed to. Mm. Actually, this was, he later on would hunt more man-eating tigers and leopards, but this was his first. He was kind of learning on the fly. And that's one of the things he realized. Initially, he had this idea of him kind of going in by himself, kind of like Beowulf, you know, and sort of tracking it down to his lair and fighting it. And he learned firsthand that that was a terrible idea. He almost got killed the first time he tried that.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, when he finally started to realize that it's really what the people there, the Pahari people and the Taru people and the Tarai and the Lowlands, have known for centuries, and that's tiger hunting is a communal activity. You know, if there is a man-eater or something like that, that's a dangerous community has to be dealt with. They know that it involves a whole community coming together. You know, traditionally would have used nets and spears, later rifles, to try to corral the tiger, you know, and eventually dispatch it. That's the strategy that Corbett eventually followed. And he couldn't have done it without the help of the local populace and of the Tassildar, who was kind of, you know, the local government official who saw over the town of Chapawat, who actually was a tremendous help to him.
Absolutely. Nice. Now, Jim Corbett, he did become legendary for felling the Chapawat tiger, but at some point he worked hard to protect tigers, even setting up the Corbett Tiger Reserve in India. Talk about this transformation, maybe underlying incidents or a series of events that made him go in this other direction.
Sure. You know, he had a very close connection to nature, to the wildlife, specifically to the Indian forest. That was a constant, a sort of love of the forest and love of the wildlife of India. I think the thing that changed, though, was, I think, earlier in his life, you know, it probably didn't occur to him that conservation so much was absolutely necessary. And he did, you know, he was not a trophy hunter in most cases, particularly when it came to tigers. He really only hunted tigers when they were eating people.
Oh, okay.
But he didn't, you know, unlike many of his cohort from that generation, he didn't kill tigers for sport. And, you know, in the vast majority of cases, it was really only, he disliked doing that. It was only when they were man-eaters and they were posing a danger to the local population. But he still did hunt them when necessary. And, you know, he was sort of a sportsman. I think what changed was when later on in his career, after having dispatched some of these man-eaters, it became clear that just sort of habitat destruction and overhunting overall had really decimated the population of wild tigers. And towards the middle of the 20th century, it became clear for the first time that tigers, if something didn't change, they'd go extinct. And that's when he really, really kind of changed gears slightly and focused just on conservation. He actually became a very early pioneer of wildlife photography. He was one of the first people to capture tigers in the wild on film. He just became this tremendous advocate for wild tigers, and he actually did lay quite a bit of the groundwork for tiger conservation. And there's a nature reserve, a tiger reserve today, that's named in his honor, the Jim Corbett Tiger National Park.
Really quickly, you have a work of fiction, Castle of Water, now optioned for a film, so congratulations there. But some of your other writings, oh, definitely. Some of your other writings are revolving around bourbon and beer. And that's great, especially in my world. But so what got you onto the subject of tigers?
I think it's mostly just a passion for history. I mean, I love writing novels, but I also, you know, I have a background. I studied history at university, and that was kind of my focus. So I've always liked, you know, tackling history, particularly from interesting angles. And, yeah, I did a history of bourbon, kind of a history of America told through bourbon, and another follow-up beer book. And I think what drew me to this story was, one, just a natural fascination with apex predators. I mean, I've always been fascinated, whether it's great white sharks or Bengal tigers or grizzly bears or what have you. Just the awe, you know, an awe of the abilities of these incredible predators, these incredible animals. And this story, I think what made it so captivating was looking into it, was it became clear, like I said, that it wasn't a case of nature gone awry, a freak of nature. It was a man-made disaster.
Yes.
And that's really, from a historian's perspective, when you start realizing there's actually a much bigger story to be told, one that deals with colonialism and deforestation and industrialization and all these other factors, that's when it became really intriguing to me, I think.
Absolutely. Wow. It's a work of nonfiction, but with so much action adventure in it, it seems like a wonderful fiction adventure. And so just to wrap, there is a danahucklebridge.com, but it's basically a black and white photo in one paragraph. Is this still under construction? I'm trying to steer people toward finding out more about your works. Where's the best place for that?
I have Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Just look for Dane Hucklebridge. Should be able to find me. I'm pretty active on those. And you can always just buy the book on Amazon at your local bookstore. Just No Beast So Fierce by Dane Hucklebridge.
Again, that's No Beast So Fierce, the terrifying true story of the Chippewa tiger, the deadliest animal in history. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Later in the program, I'll be speaking with Maddie Scully, chair of the Performing Arts Department at San Bernardino Valley College. We'll hear about quite a few upcoming performances, including Mozart's Don Giovanni. First, we have Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Rosemary Gladstar. Her new book is A Beginner's Guide to Medicinal Herbs, and that is what she's called her new book.
Thank you for joining us today, Rosemary.
Thank you, Emmanuel. I'm honored to be here.
It's great having you. I have been going through your book, Medicinal Herbs, and this is wonderful because, you know, most of us have grown up depending on pharmaceuticals or things you buy from the supermarket for aches, pains, colds, flu, what have you. And we've known that these things have been around for a long time, but I personally didn't know what to do with herbs. So, Rosemary, you are known as the godmother of modern herbalism. Why did you write this book, and what is herbalism?
I wrote this book for exactly people like you who might have an interest in reclaiming some of your self-power with healing, and for people who have no idea, you know, but were interested. And I wanted to help people bring herbs back into their home the way they have really literally been for centuries. Most places in the world still have a rich herbal tradition, but somewhere around the late 1940s, right after World War II, herbalism went deeply underground. Sort of the whole age of the chemicals, you know, the chemical revolution started, and people thought they could eat synthetic food and exist only on synthetic medicine. And we've learned that actually that isn't true, and that we really do need nature to subsist and to live a really good existence. So, you know, I wanted to help bring this back for people because herbalism has been honored for thousands of years as being a people's medicine for those everyday bumps and bruises that we encounter every day. You know, a lot of modern medicine, of course, was based on herbs. You know, they would isolate, as it evolved, they would isolate particular constituents, usually the alkaloids and glycosides out of the plant, and they started making these very potent medicines, which definitely have their place in healing. But again, you know, for all of those simple things, I like to call them the bumps and bruises of life, those everyday illnesses, herbalism is so effective and ecologically sound. We don't pollute the environment when we're using it, and it's also inexpensive. And so it just makes more sense to use this kind of medicine.
So how difficult is it to make our own recipes and get the ingredients?
Well, if you know how to make tea and you know how to pour alcohol over herbs and you know how to cook syrup and herbs, it's that simple, really. If people know how to do a little bit of cooking in their kitchen, if they can make a salad dressing or boil up water, it's easier than making chocolate chip cookies, actually. And most of these recipes, which are traditional old recipes, are really easy to make. There's no rocket science involved in it. So you can make your own syrups, your own tinctures, your own definitely herb teas, and even your own capsules and oat balls for sore throats. You can just make simply and quickly. And getting the herbs is not hard at all. Like when I first started practicing herbs and opened my little herb store in Sonoma County in the early 1970s, it was very hard to get herbal products or to get herbal ingredients. But today, like every town of any size is going to have a natural food store. It's going to have either an herb store or sometimes even a grocery store that will be selling some of these products. So it's actually easy. And there's a couple of really good sources that are online sources where people can order from. I usually suggest either Mountain Rose, which is located in Oregon, but it has an online presence, or Jeans Green, and also Pacific Botanicals. They provide really excellent herbs and different products, too, that people can buy that if they want to make syrups and other herbal products. So it's really easily. And by the way, I should also mention that you can buy a lot of this stuff right in your supermarket. You can go into the produce department and buy many of the herbs, like your ginger and your garlic, your onion, horseradish. All of those are very potent medicines.
Okay, well, I have a question to follow that up, because with so much debate about whole foods, organic and GMOs, what are the best types of ingredients to purchase if we're not growing them ourselves?
you're asking an extremely opinionated person here, but
And so am I, but go for it.
So, I mean, it's like, you know, I am not representing Monsanto at all. I think it's a bad force, an evil force in our world.
Okay.
I definitely am an advocate for organically grown food. For one thing, it and locally grown doesn't hurt the soil. You know, it's a we can't really be healthy as individuals, and I think this is one of the wider spectrum pictures that we're seeing. We can't be healthy as individuals unless our planet is healthy. Our water systems have to be clean, our soils, and we have to go back to that. We have to create a healthy environment for our children to grow up healthy. And starting by treating the soil well and growing organically, the chemicals are doing the same thing to the soil of the earth as it's doing to our own soil, our own human bodies.
Right.
And in the abundance and the amounts that we use, it's not healthy for people. And you can see that, you know, we are the richest country in the world, and we're also one of the sickest. We talk about length of life. Yes, we do have prolonged life, but that doesn't necessarily mean we have healthy life at all.
And not a good quality at all.
Yeah. We have not good quality of life. We have not extended the quality of life for most people.
Now, you know, with the GMO question, and I don't want to beat up on Monsanto. It seems like they're doing a good job. I mean, really, there for years I used to think that I grew up liking oatmeal, and then at some point I just couldn't stand it anymore, and I did not understand it until a few years ago I bought organic oatmeal and found that it tastes the same as what I was eating as a kid. It was the stuff I was buying from the supermarkets that was different. And so, you know, because of so many different side effects, I've stopped taking and using a lot of the different foods or stopped taking medications over the counter or prescribed medications. What types of side effects should we expect from herbal medications?
Well, most of the side effects actually are quite good. They make us feel better. You know, you get healthier, et cetera. So just to answer that more seriously is that most of the herbs that are available to us in the stores and that you can buy have all been deemed completely safe by the FDA, and they're heavily regulated. And so we have mostly safe plants. Those plants that were really potent were taken off the shelf, herbs like opium poppy that have, you know, very dramatic side effects. You don't have access to them anymore. For good reason. And so the side effects that people usually get from these herbs are very, if they're any, they're idiosyncratic. That means that it might be a one-on-one reaction that you might have. And it's always an allergic reaction. You might get a little itchy skin. You might get a little itchy eyes or itchy throat, which discontinues as soon as you stop taking it. Or an upset stomach, again, you stop using the herb. So they're very minor side effects that you get. And in fact, American National Poison Control, our main poison control center in the United States, get so few toxicity reports from the use of medicinal herbs, they don't even have a category for it. They do have a category for houseplants and also mushrooms because there's more toxicity. But as far as the pharmaceuticals go, you know, it's the number four leading cause of death in the United States. The last report I read was over 100,000 deaths a year from legally prescribed, properly used medication.
Yeah.
So they have a huge category for that.
Wow.
It's a sad thing, but if the U.S. government used the same standards to judge pharmaceuticals as they did herbs, we wouldn't probably have any pharmaceuticals available. Even over-the-counter medication wouldn't be available to humans or because there's so many reactions, even to something like aspirin that you can just buy, you know, over-the-counter. The side effects are there, but they're very minor, especially with the plants that we have available to us. I do want to qualify this to say I'm talking about whole plant medicine.
Yes.
If you're talking about where you're extracting a single plant constituent and then, you know, upping the dosage that people take, then you do get problems. But then that's taking the herbs into the drug realm and not using them as whole plants, as herbal medicine.
Okay, and we're also talking about organic, non-GMOs. When we're talking about side effects, because we really don't know what the side effects are with GMOs, right?
Well, right, and we're very fortunate in this country because almost all of the plants that are being grown for medicinal purposes, and we have some wonderful organic farmers in this country now.
Yes.
Almost all those plants are growing organic and very, very powerful and beautiful plants. Now, we don't have the same regulations or ability to control what's being imported into this country. So that's why I'm a real advocate for trying to use local plants as much as we can, at least plants grown in the United States by U.S. farmers who are, sadly to say, another endangered species.
Yeah, and that's also is very good economic sense just for, you know, your own country to buy things here that people were growing and helping out our own economy. So.
Yeah, aren't you proud to see now, I've seen Made in America more and more often now, even on our clothing and You know, and we do have to be really sensitive when we buy food that's imported from other countries. We really do not know who's growing, know how they're growing, and what happens in the shipping process, you know.
Right.
So I totally believe in supporting our country and its good food practices.
Yeah. Yeah, I think just makes good business. That time of year to celebrate many holidays is upon us. And I noticed something in your book about stress. There's going to be a lot of stress involved in planning and spending money and just being around each other. What kinds of things do you suggest to reduce stress, not just around the holidays, but, you know, around the year?
Well, I think one of the best suggestions I could make is stay away from the malls. but herbally, man, this could be so stressful, driving out, trying to buy all these presents and, you know, everything. I think it's less stressful to make your own. But anyway, as far as herbally goes, I would say that I would definitely recommend herbs like milky oats. It's interesting that you should mention organic oats and how good they taste when they're organic.
Yes,
so
yes.
The milky oats, which is the grain before it's fully ripe, is a powerful nerving. It's very, very relaxing to the nervous system and nerving tonic. It helps to build the nervous system, so people are really stressed out. It helps them feel calm. And also another really common herb called lemon balm, which people just grow prolifically in their gardens. That's another wonderful nerving herb. It's used for children who have ADHD and for people who are hyperactive. It's calming and relaxing and also stimulating. So these herbs don't make you feel sleepy. They make you feel oftentimes more energized, but it's a calm, relaxed energy. And another one of my favorite herbs is an herb called kava. Kava is a very powerful herb. It's very potent than, say, lemon balm or milky oats. You have to be a little bit more careful when you use it. But it's especially indicated when people have anxiety and just feel really anxious. You know, they're anxious about going to the party and to their family gatherings. They're anxious about going to the mall, you know. So
Right. Take
a few drops of kava tincture, and it relaxes the body and refreshes the mind. It actually makes you feel more alert.
Mm-hmm.
Just don't overdo it on kava. Too much kava can be not good for people. So follow the dosage that's recommended on the bottles.
Okay, now our time is growing short, but I have to ask you, where can our listeners go to find out more about this book and other books you have written?
Well, I do have a website. It's sagemountain.com. So people are always welcome to come to our website. And they can also email my office at sage@sagemountain.com, and we'll be happy to communicate.
All right. Now, we're talking about herbal remedies. What do you say to those who are skeptics about such things?
Well, you know, I never try to convince skeptics. You know, it's like there's so many great systems of healing. There's homeopathy, flower essences, herbalism. You don't have to convince skeptics. You know, if people want to use plants, they're there, and they don't have to be convinced. They're the oldest system of healing used on the planet. They're the most universal. 82% of the world's population still uses them as their primary system of medicine. For thousands of years, they've been proven effective. Today, they're still one of the most popular systems of healing. So, you know, it's like, what's the point of trying to convince people? I just say, you know, here's an incredible system. It's safe. It's inexpensive. It works. You know, and another little simple thing you could always say to people, if you don't believe in the power of herbs, go to your kitchen counter, open up the closet that has your spices, take out a little cayenne, and take just a pinch of cayenne and tell me that it's not really potent. If you don't think it's potent, take another pinch. Because even something as benign and safe as cayenne, if you take like a quarter teaspoon of that, your body's going to be on fire.
Okay.
Your circulatory system's going to be moving. So even something as simple as that can really prove to you how strong and powerful these plants are. But I think we have lots of different systems of healing because we need all of those systems. We need our modern system, especially for the life-threatening situations. We need our herbal remedies because they work so well for helping to build constitutional wellness. And we need body therapies because they help us when our bodies are ached. We need our counselors because they help us when our spirits are out of whack.
Right.
And so all of them really constitute this whole spectrum of healing and help to bring the care back into our healthcare system.
You know, I'm really looking forward myself to going home and trying some of these recipes to just have available.
Great, Emmanuel. I'm so happy to hear that. That's exactly the whole point.
All right. Well, our time is unfortunately up, but
thanks.
I enjoyed speaking with you, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Have a lovely day.
You too. This has been Emmanuel Rogers. I've been speaking with Rosemary Gladstar, author of Medicinal Herbs, A Beginner's Guide. She's also written many other books on medicinal herbs and medications and how to use them. You can find her on her webpage, mountainrose.com.
And thank you, Emmanuel. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR, online at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. For the remainder of the program, it's music and more coming to San Bernardino. I spoke with Maddie Scully, chair of the Performing Arts Department at San Bernardino Valley College. We'll hear about quite a few upcoming performances, including Mozart's Don Giovanni. I left it to Maddie to give us the full title.
Il dissoluto punito, Don Giovanni. Sì.
Nice. Literally, the rake punished. We only know it as Don Giovanni, but I think this is such a much more attractive title. It's a mouthful, but...
Not to be confused with Stravinsky's The Rake's Progress, which also uses that, which is the only other one, but that's a much more modern work.
This was a premiere that was written.
Yes.
Give us the general plot line of this. It is the story of Don Juan.
It's the story of Don Juan. I don't know how I can get around not saying this. It has particular reference to what we're going through right now socially with the Me Too movement. Because while 300, 400 years ago, they always referred to these as seductions, the reality is maybe some were seductions and others were, dare I say it, rapes.
Yes.
But it is the story of Don Juan, and Mozart set it to Da Ponte's libretto. And it's a fabulous story. He is both the world's greatest lover, according to the story, and also the world's greatest swordsman, which is very convenient and salvific, because if he weren't the world's greatest swordsman, he never could have been the world's greatest lover because he would have been killed pretty early in his career.
Yes.
But he does come to actually a sword fight at the very beginning of the opera. He is in the room of Donna Anna, a noblewoman, and he seduces her and sexually assaults her. So her father, the commendatore, who is a retired military man, probably fairly ancient, but still is ambulatory, comes flying down the staircase in pursuit of her attacker, Don Giovanni, and a sword fight ensues, and he kills the commendatore. And the plot goes on with him making other kinds of seductions. He tries to seduce Zerlina. He has an old seduction come into the opera, Donna Elvira, and she accuses him. And through it all, he continues to seduce every woman he possibly sees. He has a servant whose name is Leporello. Interestingly enough, the commendatore is a bass baritone role. Okay. Leporello is a bass baritone role. And Giovanni is a baritone role. This could really honestly be said to be a baritone's heaven, slice of heaven.
Yeah.
Because there are all these roles. There's really only one tenor role in the whole thing, Don Ottavio, who is a nobleman who is enamored with Donna Anna. But to make the story short, Leporello, his servant, says to Donna Elvira, to get her away from Don Giovanni, to get her out of the picture, he says, why are you running around after Don Giovanni? You should be grateful that you are in such good shape. You should leave here immediately. And she says, why? And he says, because you meant nothing to him. And he begins to list the number of women that Giovanni has seduced. And that very, very, very famous aria is called the catalog aria, or Madamina. And I've seen it done many, many times. I've done Giovanni myself, singing the role of Don Ottavio. But I've seen this done many, many times. And many times this catalog from which he sings is in accordion-like, and I've actually seen those pages fly out into the audience as he's singing this. And he talks about how in Italy he seduced 300 women, and in France he seduced 700 women. In the Netherlands he seduced this number of women. In England he seduced this number. But in España, 1003. So the story goes on, and the plot thickens when, in the second act, we see him going to a feast. And the commendatore, who is now dead, has had a statue raised over his grave, and Giovanni has mocked him. And at the very end of the opera, there's a feasting scene where Giovanni is feasting with Leporello, and they see the appearance of this statue for some reason right there. And he confronts the statue, and the statue comes to life, and the statue is the commendatore. And he says, I am here to take you to hell if you do not repent. And Giovanni is unrepentant, and he says, I do not repent for any of the things that which I've done. I am not terrified of you. And just before the final finale, he is taken down into hell by the commendatore, and there are demons flying around. I'm not probably going to have any demons in our production because we just don't. Well, we don't have quite the number of cast members that we need.
Okay.
Which I should tell you about this production. This is not going to be a fully staged production because I'm working with so many young singers this time. Normally, when I do Giovanni or some of these other operas, I have a little bit more advanced singers, and so they can learn the music quickly enough, and then we can have time to do blocking and stage direction and build sets and all that kind of stuff. Mm. We don't have that kind of time because we're going to present another production immediately following this for school children. So we opted for doing what is called a concert version. Mm. So the students will come dressed up in their suits, tuxedos, or gowns, and they will simply stand up, and I will introduce things, arias that they are about to sing, duets, trios, quartets, whatever, and I'll explain and act as maybe a little bit of an adhesive to tie all of these things together. So the audiences that attend will be able to hear almost the complete opera, minus the recitatives, but they will be able to hear most of that opera in all of its glory, and we're going to have a different cast for each night.
Oh, my. Which,
the reason that we're doing four performances because I have four Don Ottavios. And sometimes I only have one Leporello, so he's going to have to do yeoman's duty for the whole entire week. But that's what we're doing right now, yeah.
The scene that you were talking about, the descent into hell, is this the final ensemble that used to be omitted?
The actual descent into hell takes place about the middle of the finale. Okay. The finale starts with Giovanni and Leporello appearing at this feasting area. And there is a table laden with food, and he's eating and drinking, and Leporello's eating and drinking. And Leporello is fearful because he knows that the commendatore will probably appear. And Giovanni is saying, calm yourself, my friend. This is not something that we should bother with. It doesn't frighten me in the least. And so that scene then proceeds into the appearance of the statue, and it is part of the actual finale in the opera, yes. In conclusion, however, of the finale, after he goes to hell, the rest of the cast comes out that are remaining, Donna Anna, Donna Elvira, Don Ottavio, Zerlina, Mazzetto, all of these characters, and they always do what Mozart seems to do at the end of all of his operas, and that is everybody holds hands. It's almost like the Rockettes, and they do like a kickstep. I'm joking, but it's that kind of thing where everybody, there's a moral to be learned. The moral is put out there, and the cast is saying, so justice triumphs once again. The evil have been punished and the good have survived and that kind of thing. So that's the very, very end of the finale. But the whole scene where he's taken down into hell is a part of the actual finale, yes.
Gotcha. Okay. What kind of accompaniment do you have with this? Do you have a small orchestra?
It would be wonderful. I've tried to get an orchestra. We almost did it for last year's production of Magic Flute. We have some orchestras in the area that we might be able to get gratis, but we haven't really been able to tie the ends on that kind of thing. So we're just simply going to use piano accompaniment. We have a fabulous accompanist. We have actually a number of people who could step in and do that, which is wonderful for me because then I get to conduct instead of sitting behind the piano myself.
Yes.
But I have been known to do that many occasions, sitting at the piano and trying to conduct while I'm playing the score. So we'll see. But yes, we'll have a wonderful piano accompaniment. We will do it in North Hall 164, what is called the Recital Hall, sometimes referred to as the MAC. And we have seating for 120 people. We will have probably a flat stage with maybe a little backdrop area. We will have the people actually seated on the stage, and there may be minimal kind of contact and interaction between characters. I've told the students if they want to get a costume that's appropriate, bring it the week before and let me see it, and that will be fine too. Otherwise, to wear dressing gowns and tuxedos or suits, that kind of thing. This is the bottom line. Most productions have a minimal budget. Ours is zero and has been zero for about 12 years now. I have zero amount of money for this.
Oh, gosh.
So we borrow costumes and that kind of stuff, and we've been using a minimal set that we rearrange every year for our various productions. In the fall, we always do a little cute, a little American opera called A Mall and the Night Visitors. Mm-hmm. It's in English. It's 55 minutes long. And our purpose for doing that is twofold, to train the students. It's called my training opera, where I take students who've never sung in an opera before and I teach them the basics of singing opera. And the other purpose for it is, of course, to entertain and inform the elementary schools. We've done five or six elementary schools every year. We perform for several thousand students. We select schools that are so close to us they can actually walk over here. Mm. So we don't have to have problems with busing and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Then in the springtime, what we usually do is we'll do scores from different movies where there are popular songs that the kids would all recognize. This year, we're intending to do in April a couple of performances with the theater program. They're doing James and the Giant Peach, so they're going to cut their production down to half of the length of time, and we're going to have a very short singing of songs from movie films for a very short period of time, put them together, and then we're going to perform for four or five of the elementary schools in the area. I think Lytle Creek, Urbita, Alice Burney, Lincoln Elementary, and maybe Richardson Prep School, those kinds of things. So I've, over the years, decided that one of our goals should be to help them educate these kids and give them performances that they otherwise wouldn't see. Of course, we can't do Don Giovanni for these little ones. It's inappropriate.
Yeah, but
if we can get some high school people out, that's what we're hoping for, because this is something that the high school kids should see, because they can actually see college kids doing full-blown operas of the highest caliber and realize that they too could be involved. Normally, the only kids that get to sing opera are graduate students. When I was at SC, if you wanted to sing a role in the opera, you had to be a graduate student.
Oh, really?
Oh, that's very typical.
Okay.
The undergraduates aren't ready to handle it. So we are actually doing operas at this college. And I would say of the 114 community colleges, there probably aren't five colleges in the whole state of California that do the kinds of things that we do. We have what is called a theatrical music workshop, not a musical theater workshop. I even had to fight to get that name on there. And I remember the school was asking me, well, why do you want insist on calling it theatrical music? I said, where's the adjective and where's the noun? And the answer is you have to sing entirely differently in an opera than you would in a musical theater. And the reason is because in musical theater, they are all mic'd.
Right.
In an opera, you're not. So if you're in a musical and you have a mic, you can turn completely upstage and sing and be heard. But in an opera, if you turn even sideways, you lose half of your sound because it goes into the wings. And that's just one of the many, many things that's so completely different when you do something like an opera on stage rather than a musical theater piece.
Okay, since you are going with just piano, I think I know the answer to this, but there is and there has been done occasionally, the orchestra would do this. It was sort of a musical trick that can be presented with this, where the pit orchestra is playing, but then they've also got the dance music playing, and that's close to the same meter. Do you know what I'm talking about there?
Yes. It's actually in the score.
Yeah.
When they play this music, lo and behold, where's the music from? It's from Le Nozze di Figaro.
Yeah.
And so it was a joke. Here's Mozart in the middle of Don Giovanni, playing a very well-known operatic score that he himself wrote some years earlier.
Yeah.
So I had to explain it to my students because I've always thought that was a gas to see that kind of thing go on. And I rarely explain that before it happens. Usually I'll turn to the audience afterwards and I'll say, did any of you happen to notice and say to yourself, my, that music sounds familiar.
Yeah.
You know, I should mention to you, since you said that, it's every opera singer's nightmare that you walk out on stage and you're singing in Italian one of these operas, and for whatever reason, you find yourself singing the wrong aria from the wrong opera. It's Mozart, but it's the wrong opera. And I have to tell you, I actually, this happened to me once in a rehearsal situation where I was walking out, and I wasn't thinking what I was doing, and I was singing this recitative, which is an unaccompanied, basically unaccompanied. It has a little bit of a cello and maybe some harpsichord kind of thing underneath you, and it's just some chords. And I sang a recitative from Le Nozze di Figaro when I was actually doing Don Giovanni. And I just thanked my lucky stars it wasn't in the performance. And the lady who was playing the harpsichord just fell over laughing and laughing and laughing. And there is a thing, if you're a tenor and you sing Mozart, many of the recitatives start out with the same intervallic pattern.
Oh, yeah?
So, yes, it can be very confusing. So it was a nightmare, I had many nightmares where I would actually end up singing in the wrong Mozart opera.
Is that a Christopher Durang play? Well, it's a different, the actor's nightmare.
Yes.
That's a different thing, but yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's too funny, Mary. That is too funny. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Maddie Scully, chair of the Performing Arts Department at San Bernardino Valley College. We are speaking primarily about Don Giovanni coming up quite soon, though we'll also be hearing about several other performances and recitals up soon as well. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. So again, this is going to be, correct us on the dates.
April 3rd, 4th, 5th, and 6th, 7 o'clock, North Hall 164, the Recital Hall, or the MAC, as it's called. It is free admission. It will be concert version, as I said, where students will stand up and will announce the aria, duet, or trio, or quartet that they'll be singing, and they'll probably explain a little bit about what's going on dramatically. And then following that, we will gear up and we will start singing some songs from children's movies that the kids will find familiar, and we will then present that. James and the Giant Peach, which is the theatrical production, begins May 2nd through the 4th at 7 p.m., also May 5th at 2 p.m. Those are in the auditorium. That's the full-length production of James and the Giant Peach. That's the theatrical production.
We've been speaking primarily about Don Giovanni coming up quite soon. But now there are a lot of events once we get into May in and all around the music world. And so starting with Choir Fest.
We're hosting a festival for high school choirs in the area. We have three schools that at this point have reserved spots. It will be a two-day event. They'll come on Friday. I think it's Friday, May 3rd, and they'll spend most of that day here on campus with us, where I will listen to each choir, make some comments and some criticisms and some suggestions. They will also meet with some of our other music professors on campus in a workshop. They will work on sight singing kinds of techniques. Another workshop will be on rhythms, how to sing and perform rhythms appropriately. And then I will work with each individual choir in turn. That will take place on the 3rd, which is a Friday, from about 9:30 till about 3:30. We'll have lunch, and then we will work on a combined number. I believe I'm sending out the piece, The Last Words of David by Randall Thompson. And then the following day, on the 4th, at the Orange Chauffeur grounds, at 4 o'clock, we will present each choir as a festival choir. And they'll get up and perform three songs for the audience's appreciation. My group of Voci Soli will be there, and they will get up and perform three songs. And then to conclude that festival, all choirs will get on the stage, and we will sing The Last Words of David by Randall Thompson. So that's the Choir Fest on May 4th, and the audiences can come to that Saturday, May 4th at 4 p.m. in the Orange Pavilion. We also have a number of events. As I said earlier, James and the Giant Peach, our theatrical production for this semester, is taking place May 2nd through the 4th, 7 p.m., and May 5th, Sunday at 2 p.m., and those will be held in the auditorium here on campus. We have a dance recital, which is on May 9th at 7 p.m., again in the auditorium. Our concert band will be performing their final concert for the year on May 11th at 7 p.m. in North Hall 164. Elementary and intermediate piano and guitar recital will take place on May 13th at 7 p.m. My mixed choir will be giving a performance on May 14th at 7 p.m. We have an applied instrumental recital.
What is that?
Applied music is a class that we teach here at the college, and it is private instruction. All of those different instruments, including voice, fall under the aegis of applied music. And they're taught one-on-one with our various professors here at the school. At the conclusion of the semester, however, each student must get up in the recital format and perform three selections for the audience. And so this first one that I'm listing here is the instrumental recital program, and that is May 15th at 7 p.m. So we'll have some flutists, some guitarists, some pianists, some clarinetists, that kind of thing.
Nice.
And then we will also have applied voice, because we have so many voice students that are studying privately, and that will be on May 19th at 2:30 p.m. That's a Sunday afternoon. May 19th, North Hall 164.
It's listed here as the 17th.
May 17th is the elementary and intermediate voice recital.
Sorry.
Those are actual classes where I teach, not individually, but I teach the entire class. That is a recital that is on May 17th, correct, at 7 p.m. And those are my beginning and intermediate students who have not had private lessons. Generally, it's their first semester of singing, and they're terrified when they get up there, but it's oh so gratifying to see them actually conquer their fear, get up there and sing. The recital is given to demonstrate the knowledge that they've gleaned that semester on how the voice should function.
Okay.
And that's coming from my elementary and intermediate voice class. And then one of the final concerts of the year is Voci Soli, my most advanced choral ensemble, and that will be on May 18th at 7 p.m. And generally at that concert, we present all the music that the students have worked on that semester. And the last concert of the season is the Applied Voice Recital, as I mentioned, on May 19th, Sunday afternoon at 2:30. All of these concerts, with the exception of the theatrical production, are free. All of them are for free, and they'll all be held in North Hall 164, except for the dance recital, which is in the auditorium, and the theatrical production of James and the Giant Peach, which is also in the auditorium.
All right. With the Magic Flute not long ago and Don Giovanni right now, you have a personal love for Amadeus?
For Mozart?
Yeah.
Well, I certainly do. I was a Mozart tenor in my career as an opera singer, so I know the 6 Mozart operas. I did a few extra as well, but I know those 6 operas very, very well. It was always said to me as I was performing, if you can sing Mozart, you can sing anything.
Mm.
Mozart's music, from an opera singer standpoint, is incredibly exposed. You can't cover it up with this big bravura sound coming from an orchestra and the slurping and sliding that can frequently. And I did the same thing when I sang Puccini and I sang Verdi and those kinds of things. But Mozart basically is pristine music, vocal music. When you sing Mozart, it almost feels like a vocalise because it's so healthy for the voice. There are a few dangers in singing Mozart. You're not going to oversing Mozart and stretch the voice out of shape. It usually goes into Fach, F-A-C-H, vocal categories, that's the German word for it, that apply for young singers. Young singers can do Mozart without damaging their voices. Asking them to sing a Verdi line or a heavy Puccini work or some of the Verismo operas, this is way too mature for the kinds of student voices that we have. Mozart, however, fits the voices very beautifully. So we do all 6 of the Mozart operas, and then at the end of that 6th year, we turn around and we start all over again. We have now done Marriage of Figaro, Le Nozze di Figaro, Abduction from the Seraglio, Die Entführung aus dem Serail. We have done La Clemenza di Tito. We have done Così fan tutte. We've done Don Giovanni, and we've done a Magic Flute, the Zauberflute. So we've already made that cycle, and we're going back around. I'm thinking probably next year we will end up doing Le Nozze di Figaro, Marriage of Figaro, a cut-down version because it's way too long.
Sure, sure. All right. Well, Matty Scully, thank you so much. I appreciate your time on this. We've gone through a lot, but the first couple coming up here, we've got Don Giovanni coming up in the very near future and also James and the Giant Peach at the beginning of May. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Once again, Don Giovanni will be April 3rd through the 7th on the campus of San Bernardino Valley College, North Hall, room 164 at 7 p.m. I've been speaking with Matty Scully, chair of the Performing Arts Department at San Bernardino Valley College. And that wraps up another edition of KBC Arts. Thanks once again to Matty Scully. Thanks also to author Dane Hucklebridge and to Emmanuel Rogers in his interview with author Rosemary Gladstar. Here at KBCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Benjamin Perper, Isel Quapio, Sharina Wad, Andrew Caravella, Rebecca Ward, Taylor Milliner, and KBCR General Manager Keith Birkfeld. Music beds and themes heard on KBC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KBC Arts programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Just go to kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.